Welcome to today's program titled, My Confidential Information is Posted on the Internet. What Can I Do? At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Saifar Shah, LLP, for informational purposes only, and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. There will be an archived version of the presentation available. A follow-up email with ordering instructions will be sent out later this week. Also, you can download these materials now by going to the Handouts tab located on the left-hand side of your screen. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Paul Freeling, Scott Humphrey, and Jeffrey Swatzel. You may begin.
All right, good afternoon, or good morning to those of you joining us from the West Coast, and thank you for logging on and calling in. My name is Jeff Swatzel, and I am here with Paul Freeling and Scott Humphrey, and we're going to spend the next 40 to 45 minutes talking about how to deal with a situation that unfortunately is becoming more and more common, and that is what to do when you learn that your company's confidential information has been posted on the Internet. As we work through that scenario, we're going to discuss and focus on the following topics. First, is the information a trade secret? Does it qualify for protection under the law? And next, if it does, what action can you take against either the Internet service provider or against those responsible for posting the information? And finally, we'll look at damage control and protection. If this happens to your company, what can you do to make sure that it doesn't happen again? Now, if you find yourself in a situation where your company's confidential information is posted on the web, the first thing you need to do is determine whether that information is, in fact, trade secret information. And to do that, it's important to look at the law that governs that question. Now, that will depend in large part on where you are and the forum where that question will ultimately be resolved. For example, if you're an Illinois company and you want to bring a misappropriation action in Illinois, Illinois choice of law rules select the forum where the misappropriation took place or where the defendant obtained the benefit of the misappropriation. Another example, California, uses a different approach. California courts use a governmental interest test to determine which state's law will apply. Now, that approach looks at the respective interests of the states involved and based on that determines which law is going to apply to the question of whether or not the information is trade secret. Now, thankfully, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act helps provide clarity and avoids a lot of the choice of law issues that can arise and often do arise in other areas of the law. When we're talking about trade secrets, regardless of the forum state or the applicable choice of law rules, it's very likely that some form of the Trade Secrets Act will apply. To date, 49 states and the District of Columbia have adopted in some form or another the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. I believe that Texas and New York were the last two states to adopt the act, which leaves Massachusetts as the lone holdout that still uses the common law. So unless you're operating under Massachusetts law, the rules of the game are going to be set by the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. So how does the act define a trade secret? The Act defines a trade secret as information, including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, a technique or a process that derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means, and is the subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. Now, that's a little wordy, so we're going to break it down a little bit. And as I mentioned earlier, some states have slightly modified this language, but at the end of the day, the key elements of this definition are consistent across the board. And there are three of them that we need to focus on. First, the information must have economic value. Second, it must not be generally known or readily ascertainable by proper means. And third, it must be the subject of reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy. Now, it's important to note that all three of these elements must be satisfied in order to establish that information is trade secret. This isn't a balancing test, and we're not talking about factors that need to be considered. You need to establish all three. Turning to the first, independent economic value. What does that mean? What should we focus on? Well, a good question to ask is, does the information provide a competitive advantage? Is it something that a competitor could use to your detriment? If so, that's going to go a long way to establishing that the information has economic value. Also, were significant resources expended to develop and or compile the information? How much research and development went into creating it? How much time and money did your company spend to develop or compile that information? If, for example, it took years and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop certain information, that, again, is going to go a long way to establishing that information has value. Now, as I mentioned earlier, different states have modified the language of the Uniform Act when they adopted it, and here's an example of how Illinois has slightly changed the definition of a trade secret. Instead of using the independent economic value language, the Illinois Trade Secrets Act requires that information be sufficiently secret to derive economic value. So essentially what Illinois did is meld together the idea that information is both secret and valuable. But the bottom line is the same. You're looking for information that provides a competitive advantage, something that you don't want your competitors to get their hands on because it could provide them an advantage to your detriment. The second requirement is that the information not be generally known or readily ascertainable by proper means. Now, that's a fairly wordy explanation, but what does it really mean? How do we establish that something is not generally known or readily ascertainable? Well, how easily could that information be properly acquired or duplicated by someone else? Now, if information can be duplicated easily without considerable time, effort, or expense, that's going to weigh against trade secret protection. At the same time, if it would be practically impossible for someone else to develop or compile that information, for example, the research and development barriers are too high or the economic barriers are too high, then that information likely satisfies this second requirement. Also, it's important to look at the extent to which information is known by employees or others involved in your business. Now, how many people have access to this information? Is it known outside of your business? Customers, for example, do they have access to it? Obviously, the less people who know, the better. You know, it should come as no surprise here that the key is secrecy. Finally, the last thing that you need to establish is that you took efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain that secrecy. Now, obviously, this is a very fact-specific inquiry. What is reasonable under certain circumstances may not be reasonable under others, and vice versa. So the context is important. Generally, though, what steps can you take to ensure, or at least attempt to ensure, that your information is protected? Well, here are a few examples. Confidentiality and non-compete agreements, password-protected computer systems, limited access to facilities, making sure that employees have key cards and access to where they're allowed to go is limited, making sure information is only disseminated on a need-to-know basis, and controlling the distribution of materials that contain protected information. Now, if, for example, your trade secrets are reduced to writing or some other hard copy form, you need to make sure you don't have copies of that just lying around the office so anyone can pick it up. So, under most circumstances, implementing these types of security measures will allow you to show a court that you are, in fact, taking reasonable efforts to protect your information. So that's some background information on how to establish that your confidential information is, in fact, protectable as trade secrets. We're here today, though, to discuss what you can do when you learn that such information is posted online. In a few minutes, Paul and Scott are going to talk about enforcement, what you can do after your trade secret information is posted. And of course, if you learn that an employee or someone else with access to your trade secrets posts them on the internet, you will likely have recourse against that individual. But what about the information? What if your trade secrets have already been on the internet for a day, a few days, maybe a week, or maybe even longer? Does that information then lose its trade secret status? Unfortunately, many courts assume that the answer to that question is yes. And if you read any of the commentary or legal periodicals out there, the consensus seems to be that a trade secret posted on the web has become generally known and therefore has lost its trade secret status. So the owner of a trade secret faces an uphill battle to establish that information posted on the web can maintain that trade secret status and remain protectable. Thankfully, however, some courts have challenged and are beginning to challenge more that general assumption. For example, the United States District Court for the Northern District of California has stated that the question of when a posting causes the loss of trade secret status requires a review of the circumstances surrounding the posting and consideration of the interests of the trade secret owner and the policies favoring competition. So this is just one example where a court said this is not a simple black and white issue, and that the posting of information online does not automatically rob that information of its trade secret status. There are other things that need to be considered. And what are those things to be considered? Well, obviously, how long has the information been posted? If it's only been online for a day or two, it's going to be a lot easier to argue that the information has retained its secrecy and therefore it still should be protectable. The longer it's been online, obviously, the harder that argument becomes. Along those same lines, how widely was the information disseminated? And was that dissemination active or passive? You know, there's a difference between information that might be sitting on someone's personal webpage, maybe on a Facebook account, versus information that is emailed out to a listserv of hundreds of thousands of people. So these are all things you need to consider if you find yourself confronted with this situation and you need to establish that your trade secret information is still protected, even if it's been posted online. And with that, I will turn this over to Paul Freeling, who is going to talk about action you can take against an internet service provider.
Thank you, Jeff. Hello, everybody. As Jeff's told you, I'm going to speak to the subject of action that might be taken against the internet service provider, and Scott will follow that with a discussion of action that might be taken against the person who misappropriated the trade secret and caused it to be posted. So the topics that I'm going to discuss are the efforts to prevent posting, or if it's already posted, to take down the post and block access to it. If the confidential information is already posted and you don't know the identity of the person who posted, efforts to obtain that person's identification, the state reporters' shield laws and the Federal Stored Communications Act, and finally, a word about seeking damages against the internet service provider. Well, if the information is already posted, there's an effort that can be made, can be attempted at least, to get the posting taken down or to get access to it blocked. As Jeff has told you, time is of the essence, because once the information has been on the internet for a while, it is going to lose its secrecy value. Litigation seeking a temporary restraining order requiring that the posting be taken down or blocking access to it has to be filed in a court. And, of course, the first question is what court to file it in. There's an interesting quote from previous. There's an interesting quote from the CEO of Sun Microsystems from about 15 years ago, in which he said, "You have zero privacy. Get over it." We're learning even more about that in current days. So it's very, very difficult to get an injunction against the internet service provider. But the first question to ask is what court to file it in. And the issue of jurisdiction has been discussed in a few cases, and the most prominently cited case is Pavlovich versus the Superior Court of Santa Clara County out of California, in which the court there held that the mere fact that there's been an internet posting in your jurisdiction does not justify the bringing of a lawsuit against the internet service provider in that jurisdiction. There must be some doing business in the jurisdiction where the lawsuit is going to be brought. A mere passive citation or merely making information available is insufficient to obtain jurisdiction over the internet service provider. So it's quite possible that any lawsuit that you might try to file will have to be filed in a distant location where you can find the internet service provider. It's complicated, at least in Illinois, to obtain a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction without giving notice to the defendant and giving the defendant an opportunity to respond. And typically, when an internet service provider is sued and given the opportunity to respond to a suit to take down matters that are posted, the provider will request an opportunity and time to consult with or at least inform the person who posted the material. And again, as we've been saying, the time marches on and the posting continues to be out there and the secrecy continues to be lost. Well, the required showing for an injunction our likelihood of success on the merits, establishing irreparable injury, a favorable balance of hardships, and no adverse effect on the public interest. This is not a webinar on injunctions per se, but those are just in general terms the requirements. There is a lot of authority for the proposition that absent extraordinary and compelling circumstances, an injunction constituting a prior restraint on free speech will not be issued. And that's particularly true in the area of economic damage. The only cases that where an injunction has been entered, and there are a few of them, have involved pornography or some vile personal attack or occasionally a genuine and indisputable threat to the security of the country. But mere economic damage has rarely been found to be a basis for an injunction against the service provider. One case that seems to have allowed an injunction is the case of DVD Copy Control Association versus Bunner, another California case from 2003. This is a complicated case on its facts and a very complicated case on its procedure, and I'm not going to try to go through the entire scenario. But briefly speaking, DVD Copy Control owned confidential technology, which constituted a trade secret and which enabled encryption of a movie so that someone who bought or rented a DVD of the movie could not copy and distribute the movie without authorization. Well, according to DVD Copy Control, one John Johansson misappropriated that trade secret and used it to create a program for decrypting the encryption of the movie, which would enable the user or owner of the movie to copy it and distribute it. And then, according to DVD copy control, Mr. Johansson posted the his program for decrypting onto a website that was maintained by Mr. Bunner. And so DVD copy control sued Mr. Bunner to try to get the material that Johansson had given and placed on the internet to get it taken down. And DVD alleged that Bunner knew or had reason to know that Johansson had posted material he had acquired by an improper means. And DVD sought that injunction, and without going through all the details, the case eventually found its way to the California Supreme Court. And the California Supreme Court held that the posting on the internet or on the website of Mr. Bunner did not that to take it down did not violate the First Amendment, that the case was remanded to give DVD copy control an opportunity to prove that the four prerequisites of an injunction were satisfied. But Bunner's claim that the First Amendment or prior restraint doctrines protected against an injunction, Bunner's claims were rejected by the California Supreme Court. That's the only case I've located where a court has given comfort to someone seeking an injunction in the case of economic damage. Well, assuming that there is no point in or lack of success in seeking to get the material taken down off of the internet, it may be that the internet service provider can provide information about who did the posting. Now, sometimes, and probably most of the time, the aggrieved party knows who did the posting. It was some disgruntled employee or recently terminated employee who took materials that he or she had no right to and then provided it to the person maintaining the website. But the effort may be made if one doesn't know the identity of the person who made the post, the effort may be made to get that information from the internet service provider. And the way to do that, presumably, would be to subpoena the internet service provider to require identification of the poster. Well, again, there's the question of where to seek issuance of that subpoena and how quickly identification can be obtained. In Illinois, we have a procedure called Respondent in Discovery, which enables taking of discovery in a lawsuit filed in the Illinois state courts before there is even an answer filed or a motion filed before the case is at issue, before even there's been service of process. That procedure may not exist in any other state, and it will not work in the federal court, where there must be time for the defendant to respond to the complaint before discovery can be initiated. Your efforts to get information from the internet service provider as to who did the posting may run into a couple of significant issues. One of them is the reporter's shield doctrine. In a number of the reported cases, the misappropriator had provided the misappropriated information, the trade secrets, to a journalist, and it was the journalist who gave the information to the website operator. And efforts to find out who gave the information to the website operator have run into the reporter's shield doctrine. This is a state statute that protects reporters from having to disclose their sources. And the O'Grady case, another California case, for some reason, most of these lawsuits involving the Internet and trade secrets come out of California. But in O'Grady, the impact of the Reporter's Shield Doctrine and of another statute, which I will get to in a moment, the Stored Communications Act, came into play. In the O'Grady case, the trade secrets belonged to Apple Computer, and they were misappropriated by someone who delivered them to a journalist, and the journalist posted the trade secrets. The California Appellate Court held that the state's Reporter Shield Law, as well as the Federal Stored Communications Act, required quashing Apple's subpoena seeking identity of the persons who caused the publication. The trial court in the O'Grady case had denied a motion to quash the subpoena, and that decision of the trial court was reversed. And the court, the California Appellate Court made the following two statements. One, seeking disclosure of the contents of emails, like one seeking old-fashioned written correspondence, should direct his or her effort to the parties to the communication and not to a third party who served only as a medium and neutral repository for the message. And that's from the California Appellate Court. And the court also said, any affirmative response to Apple's subpoena would be to disclose the contents of communication by confirming that there are, in fact, stored messages on the system. So the Stored Communications Act also came into play. The Stored Communications Act is a federal statute which was designed to protect the Internet service providers, to protect the providers from being sued every time there was a posting that someone felt was improper or for which someone felt they needed information. And the Stored Communication Act protects the privacy of the content of electronically stored communications, except where there is a legitimate law enforcement justification for disclosure. The Act has an exception in it that allows the government, under certain circumstances, to obtain information about the material behind the Internet posting. But, of course, that's not going to help you very much in your business. The courts are in conflict as to whether the Stored Communications Act permits enforcement of a subpoena simply and solely asking for the identity of the persons who posted material. Some courts have held that the Stored Communication Act does prevent a service provider from disclosing the identity of a subscriber. The Jessup Morgan case is an example of a case in which the court held that the Stored Communication Act was not an obstacle to obtaining the identity of a subscriber. And one last point in this area of my remarks has to do with social media. The courts generally hold that postings on social media, such as non-public posting on Facebook, posting on MySpace, etc., that those communications are covered by the Federal Stored Communications Act. So it's not just Google, it's not just Yahoo, but it's all the all the private social media, which are also covered by the Stored Communications Act, and therefore the person who is operating those web services cannot be required to disclose information concerning the postings on the social media. Well, one last possibility you might think would be out there is to sue the social media personnel for damages. And the U.S. courts have not permitted suits against the service providers for damages. In contrast, called your attention an article in the New York Times earlier this month entitled "French Court Tells Google to Block Images in Privacy Case." And in Europe, there are procedures for going to court and getting service providers to take down material and also to award damages against the service provider. But that tendency in the European courts has not crossed the Atlantic, and it's not available in the United States.
Thank you, Paul. This is Scott Humphrey, and I'll now talk about what you can do with respect to the bad guy, the person who actually stole your confidential information and had the nerve to put it on the internet or some other social media. But before I do that, let me give you the all-important webinar code, which is SS6090, Seyfarth Shaw 6090. Now, the first place that you should always start with when looking at enforcement against a former employee, or even a current employee for that matter, who has posted your confidential information, your trade secrets on the internet, is the agreements that you have with them. Typically, you have employment agreements as well as confidentiality agreements that may have restrictive covenants in them about what that person can and cannot do, but also have confidentiality restrictions that in a nutshell say that this person will only use your confidential information on behalf of the company. They're only providing access, or the company is only providing access of confidential information to this employee so that they can perform their services on behalf of the company. And they also typically have confidentiality provisions that say this person will not use your confidential information for any improper purpose, will return this confidential information upon request or at their termination, and most importantly, will do no harm to the company either before or after they leave the company in a way that could hurt the company by using, and in this case, posting confidential information in a public space. Jeff did a very nice job about talking about the Trade Secrets Act, and so I won't dive into that. But what Jeff's key takeaway is, or one of the key takeaways is, you know, the Act allows you certain enforcement mechanisms, even without an employment agreement, even without a confidentiality agreement. And when you get into litigation in these cases, sometimes you'll hear, and typically from an attorney who's maybe a little more green or a little too green with this type of law, that, oh, well, you didn't have me sign any confidentiality agreement or employment agreement, or you didn't have me acknowledge the handbook that says I can't, you know, use confidential information for an improper purpose. That's a fatal argument to them. It's not an argument that will win. And part of the reasons why, as Jeff pointed out, under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act is, if you can show that you took the steps to keep this a trade secret, if you can tell the court that you not only took those steps, but this person knew because of those steps and because of what they were doing for you that this was trade secret information, and that they have then misappropriated this information in a way that harms the company, the Trade Secrets Act gives you protection even if you don't have a written agreement. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as the Espionage Act, also provides you additional protections even in the event that you don't have a signed employment agreement or a signed or executed confidentiality agreement. And just like the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Espionage Act allow you to obtain temporary restraining orders, preliminary injunctions, permanent injunctions, as well as money damages in the form of lost profits, damage to a goodwill of the confidential information, or diminishing in value to a trade secret, as well as, in certain cases, royalties, as well as, I should also add to that, attorney's fees. So moving past the Trade Secrets Act, let's now talk about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has been around since 1984. But with respect to civil litigation, it really came about in 1994 when the act was amended to allow for a civil cause of action. And basically, there's two areas, or two criteria, I should say, for the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. One is, did this person, without authorization or exceeding authorization, enter your network? And two, did they do so in a way that caused damage? It's the exceeding authorization part of this act that has really caused some heartburn and difficulty in interpretation by the courts that have looked at CFAA claims. And I think the best example of it is actually a criminal prosecution that arose in California, the U.S. versus Nozzle case, where Mr. Nozzle was a high-level executive at an executive recruitment and placement firm. And while he was still there, but before he left to go to a competitor, he accessed a bunch of customer information, a bunch of customer lists, some information on, you know, key clients, key relationships, things like that. And his employer notified the U.S. government, who then has filed and prosecuted Mr. Nozzle under, among other things, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Mr. Nozzle was convicted on two different counts of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Those counts then went up to the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court, and the Ninth Circuit came back and said, whoa, well, let's wait a minute here. You know, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was about hacking. Mr. Nozzle didn't hack the systems of his employer. What Mr. Nozzle did was he basically just stole trade secrets, and that wasn't the purpose of this act. So they threw out the trade secrets counts, sent it back, and Mr. Nozzle has been set for sentencing at the end of December on the remaining counts, the espionage counts and some other violations, but not on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So then everybody thought, well, okay, so this isn't going to really be a statute that employers can use to go after employees who access their systems for trade secrets and then use them in a bad way, such as putting them on the internet. Well, then along came another case out of California, a district court case called Weingarten versus Harlan Financial Solutions, which took a different look at the Nozzle decision and said, oh, no, wait a minute here. There's still going to be situations where employers can use the CFAA to go against individuals who use their trade secrets and access their systems to misuse and abuse trade secrets in a way that harms the employer. And the rest of the 12 circuits of the federal courts are split on this, and it's something that we will continue to monitor here at SafeHearth, and we'll keep you abreast and abreast of what the rulings are. Because really what it's coming down to now is, what does exceeding authorization mean, and can you exceed your authorization when you're allowed onto the network, but you are accessing other parts of network, confidential information of that network that you don't need to do your job, and then you take it and you either post it on the internet or you use it in a way that harms your employer. Is that more than just a Uniform Trade Secrets Act claim? Is it also a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim? So the key takeaway there is, when you're looking at these types of issues, understand where your employee is and where you are and what case you will be in, what form you'll be in, because as Paul mentioned to you earlier, that's an important part of the test. So then we get to the Economic Espionage Act. And the Economic Espionage Act has also been around for quite some time, but it really took notice with respect to civil matters last year, because last year President Obama was able to pass legislation that amended it so that it's no longer just a criminal statute, it's also a civil cause of action statute. And what that did was it not only allowed employers to use the Economic Espionage Act in a way that can protect their trade secrets, confidential information, it also kind of jump-started the Department of Justice in their criminal prosecutions of trade secrets under this act. And so in the last year, we've had 12 criminal trade secret prosecutions using this, along with other acts, but using this act to go against individuals who stole their trade secrets of their employer and now are causing harm because of it. The key issue in the Economic Espionage Act with respect to today's call is, do the trade secrets, do the confidential information, are they products that are in the interstate or foreign commerce? And this is a question that's out there and ongoing, because you have the trade secrets, the formulas to Coke and Pepsi. It's pretty clear that those are trade secrets that are in interstate commerce because Coca-Cola and Pepsi are all throughout the United States and the globe for that matter. Where it becomes a little more sketchy and a little more difficult is for confidential information that's only limited to a certain jurisdiction. And what I mean by that is if you take, for example, an insurance company or a financial services company that's local and they have their customer list, they have their individual list that talk about preferences of their customers. If you take that information and you put it out on the public domain, out on the internet through a Facebook posting, well, the initial examination of looking at that is, well, that's customer information, but that's limited to a certain agency. It's limited to an agency in Chicago. That customer information doesn't deal with customers in Indiana, Michigan, Detroit, Wisconsin, what have you. So is it truly in the interstate of commerce? And the response back to that is, well, you put it into the interstate of commerce when you put it on the World Wide Web. And that's an issue that hasn't been decided yet and that, again, will be monitoring because it's going to be an issue that's going to have to be flushed out here as more and more companies go forward with prosecutions under the Economic Espionage Act. What I should also add is you see in here down at the bottom, it says civil penalties and fines in addition to standard damages. And that's significant because unlike the Trade Secrets Act, which allows you attorney's fees and treble damages with respect to the loss in value of the trade secret, the Economic Espionage Act actually has some pretty significant penalties for violating it, such as a $500 to $5 million penalty for individuals. And for organizations that have violated the act, it's $10 million are three times the value of the the stolen trade secret to the organization. So, again, when you're evaluating these claims, when you're speaking with your outside counsel about what has been done to you, how you have been harmed, and what are the steps that you need to take in order to stop the harm, these are three acts that you need to be aware of and that your outside counsel should be aware of. So then the next step is, all right, We have these trade secrets out there on the World Wide Web or on a Facebook post. What do we need to do? And I think you can really divide that into what do we need to do now, and then how can we learn from that situation? So with respect to what you need to do now, the initial steps is, first, you need to figure out what's been taken, what's missing. And a lot of times you can do that on a search, but for some of you at larger corporations, it's not simply just an HR search. It's something that you actually need to get forensic either through IT or always being cognizant of your IT's limitations as well as the need to preserve whatever you find. You might need an outside vendor to basically search your systems, find out what else has been accessed, because sometimes it's not just the initial post that harms you, it's the subsequent post. You know, a leaker who decides that every day they're going to release one of your trade secrets through the World Wide Web. So that's why it's important to not just focus on what is out there, but what could be out there. And that's why the first step always has to be what's missing and what's been accessed. You can usually find a lot of this out when you identify who would be the likely culprit. Have they left? And then who are the people that they worked with or that they were close to at your company? Speaking with your employees is usually a really good way to find out who's doing what and when they did it. Also, depending on the situation, depending on your client relationships, it might make sense to reach out to your clients to find out what they know about this. It's amazing how many times a rogue employee it gets upset with the company, lips off to a couple of customers about how they're leaving, going to a competitor, and by the way, they're really going to get the former employer back by posting all this information. So speaking to individuals both inside and outside your organization is always a good thing. And we talked about forensic review. Also, there's a preservation issue here, and there's always a preservation issue here. As soon as you start talking about litigation and actions that you may or may not take, and obviously all of you know about the litigation hold letters that need to go out, but there are also preservation issues that focus not only on e-discovery, forensic type issues, but also just general gathering of information, speaking and interviewing witnesses. So it may be wise to consider bringing in outside counsel initially to conduct the forensic reviews, the investigations, basically the evidence gathering, so that you know that you have, one, protected information, two, you have attorney-client protection in certain areas if you need it, and three, you have preservation of evidence so nobody can ever accuse you of spoiling or misappropriating or damaging in a way the evidence that you're going to need to go in to get those injunctions that we talked about earlier. But the question that also always needs to be asked is, how did we get here? You know, how do we get to this point that our confidential information, our trade secrets are now found on Facebook or the World Wide Web, that we have this leaker? And that then gets into, okay, well, what can we do? What steps can we take to prevent, you know, the following, the confidential information? And so let's talk about that for a second. What's the practical steps that we can take to hopefully minimize, you can never eliminate, but hopefully minimize the likelihood that your confidential information is on or is not on the World Wide Web or on Facebook or what have you? Well, the first step is you should look internally and see what you have. First, look at your agreements with your employees. A lot of you have non-compete restrictive covenant agreements. That's great. Most of you probably tie confidential information into those restrictive covenant agreements because in several states you need that tie-in in order to make them enforceable. But you should also look at your other agreements. Do you have proprietary information agreements? Do you have NDAs? Do you have return of material agreements? Do you have invention assignment agreements? All of those are good protection from an internal basis, as well as employee policy and handbooks, that will give you the necessary protection that you need if, God forbid, you have to go into court to enjoin someone from using your confidential information or to get that information off the World Wide Web or social media. Also, do you have confidentiality agreements with your third parties, with your clients, with your vendors? Do you do due diligence there when you are looking to acquire someone? Because a lot of times, you know, you could have a vendor where you're sharing confidential information, that relationship goes south, and the next thing you know, your confidential information is out there. So those are things to look at, as well as your security for your network and your facility. Do you password protect your computers? Do you password protect your confidential information? Do you have different levels of confidentiality protection? And what I mean by that is the confidential information that's most crucial to you, that formula for Pepsi or Coke, is that something that everybody in your company has access to, or is it only something that the people who need it to do their job have access to? So do you have different layers of confidentiality protection? Lastly, it's a simple thing, and I think a lot of people are surprised at how significant this simple thing is to courts, is how are you labeling your information? Is that confidential information? Is that key marketing study or that key customer information? Do you designate it? Do you stamp it confidential? When somebody accesses that information on your internal intranet site, do they see a label there that says that this is confidential for only your company's use and to only benefit your company? Those are important little steps that that clients and that courts, more importantly, really rely on when assessing whether or not they're going to take the necessary relief that you need to get your confidential information off the World Wide Web and social media. With respect to the digital age, you know, a lot of us are telecommuting now. A lot of us, have everything on our phones that we need to do our job. So what's your computer and communication system policies? Is that something you need to look at? Are those systems encrypted? Are they systems that only allow me certain assets to access? And what I mean by assets to access is it a situation where I can, through my PDA, access everybody's confidential information, even the confidential information I don't know? Or does my PDA, my laptop, my phone only get access to the information that I need to do my job? Another thing that you can always look at with respect to personal devices is who owns them. I mean, if the company owns your phone, if the company owns that laptop that you are iPad that you use to do all your work, well, then you get to take that iPad, that phone, that computer back when that person terminates their employment or you terminate their employment. But even if you don't, you can still have media protections in place, social media protections in place through your handbook and confidentiality policies that say, hey, listen, you may have your own phone, and that's fine, but we are allowed to inspect it and to ensure that our confidential information is not on it, or if it's on it, that it's been removed when you leave the company. And that's why you get then to what is one of the aspects of best practices, and that is when this person leaves with you, it's always good to have an exit interview to find out what they have, what they don't have, or what they might have. Because it's amazing how many times somebody says goodbye, you say goodbye to them, and then it turns out that they have everything on that laptop because they've been telecommuting from home for the last year and a half, and you need to get it back. And obviously somebody's a lot more cooperative with you before they leave through the exit than after they leave through the exit. When you conduct that interview, it's great to do with HR. That's what HR is there for. What it's also good to is in case you have a lot of social devices, phones, computers, PDAs, iPads, what have you, that could have your confidential information, it's important to have an IT person there, if you have such an IT person, so that if you need to remove the confidential information, you can do so, you can acknowledge that you've done so, and then that person walks out with their own personal stuff on their phone, but not your stuff. Also, you know, we mentioned walkout here. It's important to shut down the person's access to your confidential information when they give you termination notices. And it's important to make sure that they understand that when they're leaving you, and that then you make sure that they can't get access to your confidential information after they leave. So when we talk about walkout, we're not talking about, you know, perp walking them through your company with the two biggest people you can find and then making them have a nice swift kick out the door. What we're talking about there is just a walkout in the sense of we've talked about our confidential information. Do you have any of that confidential information? No, you don't have any of that confidential information. Okay, affirm that to us, and then, you know, we wish you the best of luck. Also, then, if after that it turns out that your information does wind out there on social media, then, you know, the best practice for what to do is pretty much what we told you at the very beginning when I started speaking. Interview the employees. You can, more times than not, be able to create an electronic footprint of what they've done through their email, what they've accessed for you within the last 24, 48, 72, or even in some corporations larger than that, months go back, so that you can see what they've done both on their email activity about as well as what they've accessed on your computer systems to see if, in fact, they took something that they weren't supposed to take and that they lied to you about it in the post-termination interview. You can also, assuming that you have to have swipe cards to get in and out of your building or in and out of your offices, you can look at those records to see, hey, did this person stop by Sunday afternoon from 4 in the afternoon to 11 at night in our building? Because if they did, odds are they probably weren't doing something that they were supposed to. Again, you know, we talk about it here in the beginning as well as at the end of this best practices slide. Interview the employees. It's amazing how much employees talk before they leave, and it's amazing how many people remember that conversation, and that's definitely an area that you should explore and not be afraid to approach, albeit in a professional way, if you find out that your confidential information is either at risk or potentially could be at risk. Lastly, we recommend that companies engage in this, and it really depends on the sophistication level as well as the type of company on a yearly basis, semi-annual basis. Again, it depends, but we recommend that every so often you should conduct an audit to see and identify, A, your trade secrets, your practices, and how can they be approved? Because the first thing that you should always do is look at, hey, what are the most important things that we can't have out there on the web? That if we have them out there on the web and we lose that confidential protection, we're in a lot of trouble. Because when you start with that practice and you start with that question in your audit, you can then look at and say, okay, well, then if these are the steps that I need to protect, these are what I need to protect, what can I do? All right, let's talk about those, and let's talk about what we can do to create a bubble around them to insulate them from disclosure or improper use, or most importantly, God forbid, placing on the internet. Because you'll find out that, A, your trade secrets might not be as protected as you think they are, B, where you can get protection and how you can protect them, and then C, you can use your audit as a basis for going into court to showing, back to what Jeff talked about way back when, steps that you took to make sure that this confidential information was protected. So that's the benefit of a trade secrets audit. And then the last thing, and this ties obviously into the audit and what we've talked about today, is it's the old Ben Franklin adage, an ounce of protection is worth a pound of cure. It's always easier, not to mention less expensive from both an outside counsel as well as an internal perspective, to take the steps to protect your confidential information now as opposed to afterwards when you're paying the lawyers to litigate in the case. And then you're also saying, okay, now we need to assess of how did we get here and what can we do to make sure that we don't get here again. A lot of those questions and a lot of those steps can be addressed a lot more economically through that trade secrets audit, through knowing what your trade secrets are now and identifying them, knowing where you have some gaps or some issues, and then plugging those gaps or taking care of those issues so that you don't find yourself in a situation where somebody's telling you, I just saw Sally's Facebook account, and guess what's on there. So now we're going to pause for a minute and take your questions. But the one thing that we would like to leave you with is the following. Don't forget to follow us on our Trade Secrets blog. It's tradesecrets.com. It's a great place for you to stay up to date on trade secret issues. We follow these issues, including the Trade Secrets Act, the CFAA, the Espionage Act, on a very close basis. So we encourage all to visit that website. And now we'll pause for a minute while we read through any questions. And if you have questions, now is the time to submit them.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. We are now ready to begin. The first question asks, we got ISP to remove original posts, but now others are repeating the trade secret in their posts, and the ISP refuses to remove them. What options do we have in this situation?
It's a great question, and it's one that gets asked a lot of us. And the short answer is that there's no easy answer, because a lot of this is sort of guerrilla warfare, where you have to, you know, take the sniper where he is and take care of him, then go from there. What I would say to this question, and it's a little off topic, is you have to stay vigilant, and this is why the preliminary investigation is so important, because you can look at and find out, okay, Sally took X, but and X is up there now, but she also took X, Y, and Z. So hopefully that first injunction can prevent Y and Z from being disclosed on the internet. To address the specific this question more specifically, is you have to just stay vigilant, and each time you see it up there, you have to just keep going after it. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to get a court to say, hey, internet service provider who just posted this isn't involved in the, you know, atrocity or the misappropriation, other than just happening to be the source. It's very difficult to get an ISP provider to, or a court to order an ISP provider to take affirmative steps to flush through their total website to make sure that this doesn't keep popping up. So the diligence really falls on the company to continue monitoring this and make sure that they shut it down, as opposed to trying to place that burden on the ISP.
Thank you. The next question asks, how do we get a trade secret legislation comparable to the DMCA?
Okay. I assume when you talk about DCMA, you're talking about the Digital Copyright Millennium Act, which is another tool, I would say. The DMCA, though, and this is the difference between copyrights, patents, and trade secrets that we're talking about today, is copyrights, patents, those are everything that's out there. I mean, you tell everybody, hey, this is my patent. I'm making it, you know, so that the world knows. And I don't care if you're in the United States, you're in China, you're wherever. Don't copy my stuff. What we're talking about here is trade secrets. We're talking about the formula for Coke or the formula for Pepsi. And that's why for those things, for stuff that you keep internal, that you say, these are my confidential information, and I'm not telling the world because it is so valuable to me, that secrecy is so valuable to me, the best steps and the best mechanisms there is to go through the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, and the Economic Espionage Act. Now, with respect to legislation, there has been legislation introduced in Congress. It was introduced last year, was introduced again this year, that talks about an actual National Trade Secrets Act, and we have been monitoring it. There's no telling what will happen if that stuff will actually get out of committee. Even though they don't seem to want to do anything, the Congress seems to have a lot on its plate. But we can't really gauge what Congress will do or if it will do anything with respect to trade secrets, given the focus that it has on these other issues. Like I just saw on the way up here that the Senate is bickering over filibuster. And, you know, if they're going to be bickering over filibuster and they're not getting their arms around the debt ceiling and other things like that, it's hard to believe that they actually would come together to pass federal trade secret legislation. But that's another reason why you should follow our blog, because if they do pass it, if it does get out of committee, if there actually are hearings on it, you'll be able to know about it through our blog, because obviously that's something that we monitor very closely. There's a really good question here that is asked. When marking information as confidential or trade secret, is there a danger in being too liberal with such designations? The answer is absolutely. And that's why you have to be real careful about when you use that designation or if you want to layer that designation. And what I mean by layering that designation is you can have different levels of protection. The government is known for, it has its confidentiality layer, then it has eyes only layer, then it has attorney's eyes only layer, and then it has executive order eyes only layer, which is the president, certain, levels of his cabinet and real high level people. I'm not suggesting that you layer your stuff to that degree, but this is where an audit really comes in, is if you, what you really need to ask yourself is this stuff that's so valuable to us that if our competitors got a hold of it, we're in a lot of trouble, or if it gets posted out on the internet so our competitors can see it, is it going to give us a lot of trouble? That's the stuff that you should really be leveling and designating as confidential trade secret information, because a court will give you trade secret protection that we talked about here today for that type of stuff. If you level everything under the sun as confidential information, you walk yourself into a trap where a court will not give you that information because you're not taking your responsibility of adequately ensuring measures to protect your most important stuff. And that's obviously not legal terminology, that's my terminology, but what a court basically says is if you label everything confidential, then you're really not complying with the Uniform Trade Secrets Act requirements, or the CFAA, or the Economic Espionage Act requirements for that matter, because not everything you have can be a trade secret, okay? Not every marketing pitch can be a trade secret. Not every sales slide can be a trade secret. If you take the surgical approach here, which is what we recommend, of, okay, this stuff is important to us, this customer list is important to us because only 6 people have access to it, and if it gets posted on Facebook, we're in a lot of trouble. That's the type of stuff that wins for you in court, and that's the type of stuff that you should be focused on protecting as opposed to the blanket stamp of anything that comes across my desk is going to be labeled confidential. I now understand we're now out of time. So for those of you whose questions we did not answer, we will take care of that through email. And we thank you all for staying with us for this past hour. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.